I will inherit the moon, and I'll die in the earth.
Welcome to our group.
And this ought to show it right here.
Do you or someone you know suffer from depression? If so, please contact the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to our Medical Tuesday night broadcast with your host, our Colonel, Kimberly Purvis. Before we get on with the show, I need to read our disclaimer. The views and opinions expressed on the Defender 7 radio show and Facebook page are those of the callers and or authors and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Defenders 7. Now, for those of you new just tuning in to us, we can be reached on our national Facebook page by typing in all capital letters in the search box, Defenders 7. Now, before you hit that join button, just know we expect all of our members and future members to participate in everything we do here in the Defenders 7. If you get in and feel it's not for you, you may leave. No hard feelings. We are one big extended family, and we treat each other as such. Get a chance, hop over to YouTube, check out our YouTube page, click that subscribe button for us. We're also on MeWe. If you click on organizations and scroll down to Defenders 7, Humanitarian American Patriot Group. We have a website. If you type in all lowercase letters, www.defenders.com. On our site, you will find that we have a store and a donate button. 100% of all proceeds, sales from our store, and any donations we bring in go back to our communities throughout all 50 states in a time of need. That's 100%, folks. We're not like the other groups where they keep 90% and only distribute 10%. We are 100%. So by all means, please purchase something from our store or click that donate button. Every penny helps and our communities. Now for tonight's show and all the shows we do here on Blog Talk Radio, we enjoy it when you call in. But if you're too scared to call in, we also have a live chat room here on Blog Talk. So check us out. If you want to call in and participate, area code 914-205-5773. Again, number to call to participate, area code 914-205-5773. Now I would like to welcome our colonel, your host, Kimberly Purvis, and our major, Lorna Munson.
Howdy, howdy.
Good evening.
How are you?
Good, you?
Not too bad. Making coffee. If I could stay up all night long. I wish decaffeinated coffee didn't raise your cholesterol, or I would drink it. I don't know. I like my Keurig coffee. A little
right.
pod, you just make one cup at a time, and boom, done. But, unfortunately, I shouldn't be drinking coffee this late, but hey, what the hell, you know?
Right.
My dogs don't let me sleep anyway. I might as well be sitting up in my chair, little assholes. Yeah, they're just both looking at me like, what? I swear, they were up every hour and a half last night to have to go to the bathroom. I'm like, I don't even pee this much. But I got some good news, and it better be done by tomorrow or tomorrow's Wednesday. Hopefully, by Thursday, it'll be fixed. I posted on Facebook the State of Tennessee Board of Nursing is about as useless as this administration. if your license expires by accident or whatever, and you go to renew it or get it reinstated, apparently the woman in charge of that department doesn't give two shits. Because on August 4th, like I've been bitching about this, August 4th I sent in my $200 because they double fine you. If it expires, normally it's $100. But anyway, so I send in my fingerprints to the FBI and the state and all their bullshit paperwork, right? August 4th now. It is October the 19th, and my license still isn't renewed, right? So come to find out, I was missing one paper. They forgot to send them all to me. So I'm like, okay, yeah. No big deal, right? August the 23rd. I get the email. I'm like, okay, cool. She goes, this is all we're waiting on. I'm like, cool. I download the paper, fill it out, sign it, and I email it back to her at 10:23. You know that bitch never even opened up her email? As a matter of fact, I emailed her 10 times since the 23rd, actually the August 27th to yesterday. I emailed her 10 times, and they have 72 hours to return an email. She never once opened any of my emails, so I called today again and spoke to just some random person who answered the phone. And she's like, you know what? This should have been done way back then. And I'm like, yeah, you're right, it should have. But I'm not mad at you. So I emailed her boss. And I found the email where I had sent the declaration of state of residence or whatever the hell it was. That very email that said what time she received it. And I emailed her boss. You know her boss has already received that email? The one that I sent her today? So hopefully in the next 2 days, they have 72 hours. And this is the big boss. This is the head of nursing in the state of Tennessee. So hopefully I'll have – I've already got a job. They're just waiting for me to get my license renewed.
So you mean you have a job in Tennessee or in
– In Kansas.
Kansas.
Yeah.
Oh, so you –
I got offered
your license.
Oh, no. Well, see, I did get offered a traveling job, $50 an hour. 10-week contract to go whatever state I wanted to go to. And I'm like, nah, I don't want to do that. Because I was going to do that. I was going to go to Tennessee and then Kansas, go back and forth because my family, my daughter and my granddaughter is in Tennessee. So I said, why not? What the hell? And so I'm like, no. No. I can't, I don't want to work in Tennessee anymore. But anyway.
Hey, hold on. And your dog, what would you do with your
You'd have to have somewhere to stay, and what would you do with your dog?
Oh, no, they pay you. If you do travel nursing, they provide you with a place to stay. Usually it's a hotel.
Right. Okay.
But you get stipend. Yeah. But I'm not going to do it. I'm just going to stick to the home health company. It's one patient every day. Well, 5 days a week, 40 hours a week. So, and I'm just going to do that. No boss over my head. No other staff, just me and the kid. So, just hopefully it's not pushy family, because I hate pushy family. I've dealt with those, and they're assholes. I had one lady, or one kid, well, I say kid. He was 17, but he had CP and a few other health problems, and it was her stepson. Okay, but.
And
she married you not being
vaccinated?
Huh?
They're okay with you not being vaccinated?
Yep.
Good.
The guy said, you have a brain, right? He said, you can think for yourself, don't you? He said, as long as you made it, you know, an educated. I'm like, no, dude. I said, it's got nothing to do with the science. And I said, the science is the reason why I'm not getting it. I said, it will probably kill me, literally, because I'm allergic to what's in vaccines. And he said, oh, that's a legit reason right there. I'm like, yeah. So he said, all I have to do is wear a mask. And that's fine, because these are children from birth up to 18, and they're on ventilators, feeding tubes. I mean, they have all kinds of medical equipment. And for that, I don't have a problem.
Oh, no. I mean, wearing a mask for medical reasons, you know, because that's not, we've been doing that for decades in isolation wards and everything. That's, you know, that's understandable. And I'm glad you were able to find something that you like in your, you know, near your home. It sounds like
Our VA is not making it mandatory to get the vaccine. If you have a medical exemption, then you don't have to get it. But, yet again, I don't want to have to deal with the bureaucracy and the rest, all of that crap. I like pediatrics, you know. And I won't wear my mask if I'm not taking care. Like, if I'm doing patient care, yes, I'm going to wear a mask, especially if they have a trach or an event. Not all trach patients have a vent. Some do, some don't. So some are only on the vent while they sleep, and they have. So, of course, any interaction that I have with a child doing patient care, I'm going to wear my mask or, you know, things like that. But other than that, no. And I'll just keep it under my chin, you know what I'm saying? And when I have to work with them, I'll put it back on. See, I'm used to wearing the gloves and all of that shit anyway.
Right. Now, like I said, for nursing, I mean, for some nursing stuff, I mean, we've been using masks and gloves forever, so that's really, they're going overboard with it. And the problem. Here in Pennsylvania, I just read an article or saw a video, whatever. There's actually a hospital here in Pennsylvania that is not forcing their people to get a vaccine if they can prove they had COVID and have the virus.
Oh, yeah. All they got to do is a titer. And that's it.
No. I understand here's the thing. Any kind of exception or exemption is not good, to be quite honest. Still means that you still have to prove it. You still still need paperwork. It's not getting rid of the mandate. It's just giving a particular person a reason to accept it. You know what I mean?
No, I know. But you see, you know what? Honestly, one blood draw to say, yep, I had COVID. Okay. I don't care about that.
Still, you know,
I'm just not getting the vaccine.
You're not hearing me. The problem isn't the vaccine. The vaccine mandates are going to lead to the vaccine passports, which are going to lead to that social credit system. You're going to have to carry paperwork to prove that you've either been vaccinated or that you have a religious exemption, a medical exemption, or whatever. You're still going to have to carry paperwork.
Okay, but here's the thing. Vaccine passports are already in New York and California. They already have them. That's why people are protesting and boycotting businesses that ask for them. There's this guy.
Stop fighting? Because they're already out? I said, so because they're already out? I guess I'm misunderstanding. I guess because they're already out, that means that we should just accept it?
No. What I'm saying is they're already out, so there's no getting around it. They're out. But what I'm saying is there's people that got the vaccine by choice. And if they go to a business that says, can I see your vaccine, your card or whatever, they're not going in. They're boycotting those businesses because it's nobody's business. And they're like, we don't care either way. And so they're promoting this, and a lot of unvaccinated and vaccinated people are standing together to say, look, you know, it's our choice. And if the vaccine really works, then whoever's not vaccinated, it doesn't matter.
Right.
And now all these people, these high ups, are dying of COVID after being fully vaccinated. Now, what do you think is going to happen? They're going to blame it on the unvaccinated. Why? You had a vaccine. What does it matter? That's just the way it is. But hopefully tonight we should finish up the book. I'm not going to do the medication. I mean, it's kind of whatever. We've covered medication so many times, you know. But tonight I'm going to go ahead and go back and start. We got head injuries and then sprains, strains, dislocations, amputations, and things like that.
What do you do for a human bite again? I told you about my friend. It seems that infection she has on her finger was a human bite on her finger.
Oh.
And it's infected.
Okay.
Well, I guess
she
got into a fight with her boyfriend, and he grabbed a hold of her finger and bit down and used it. I mean, you know, so she's bleeding. I mean,
how bad?
I can tell you, it's bad. I saw a picture of it.
No, I mean the bite itself.
Yeah, it broke this. It's a serious blood and breaking the skin. Hang on a minute. I'll share a picture in.
So here's the thing. One, she needs to make sure she's had a tetanus shot within the last 10 years. She needs to wash it with soap and water, leave it open, unless now she can do the honey thing. They do make honey in the medical. Go like, well, if they're in Australia, I don't know what kind of stores they have, or, you know, like Walmart and whatever. But it's medical honey, and they even have bandages that have the honey that's infused in it, and they can use that. She could clean it with peroxide, but not repeatedly. Cleaning with peroxide one good time is okay to do, but not every day all the time. That's not really good. and then leaving, or she could leave it open to air if it's not, like, draining and stuff like that. But a human bite is worse than a dog bite.
I know. That's why I'm concerned. And she's in Australia, so they're being, you know, and she's not vaccinated and refuses to get the vaccine.
But that's what she can do. Now, there is that concoction that has the honey, cinnamon, ginger, turmeric, and vanilla.
Uh-huh.
It does work. It does work.
Okay, yeah, I'll have to write that down. I don't have a pen.
I'll just send you a copy of it. But it's really
right.
Simple. It's good for coughs and colds and things like that, but it's all of that stuff together is an antibacterial or antibiotic effect. My son was coughing really bad, and he took it a teaspoon every 6 hours, boom, and he took it for like 2 days. It's gone.
Okay, so I just shared pictures over for that,
okay.
You know, after it happened and then like over the next 24 hours type of thing. I mean, and you
let
can
see
the pus.
Let me look at it real quick.
I mean, it's bad.
Oh, okay.
I mean,
oh, that's not that bad.
It's infected.
And the one with the green is now? That's
that,
not that,
no, no,
that
no,
bad.
The one down at the bottom, I put them in order. That was from like 6 hours and then 4 hours. And then, so the one was the first one from yesterday. And then because she shared it with me this morning. And then the green one, she said, so it was about maybe 18 hours and then 12 hours and then, you know, like 8 hours or something like that. The one at the bottom is the most recent, and it does look
yeah.
a little better, but, you know, cleaner, but still, I mean, you know, it's not good.
Tell her to wash it with like Dial or Irish Sprint, whatever, kind of soap, antibacterial if she's got it, whatever, it doesn't matter. And then
okay.
you can use a washcloth, kind of scrub it around. Don't do it too hard until it bleeds. God forbid, don't do that.
Right.
And then she can, like I said, leave it open to air, or she can, she can also soak it in Epsom salt.
Yeah, that's what
for
I
a little
thought.
Bit.
Epsom salt, but although it might hurt.
Now, Epsom salt won't hurt.
Oh, okay.
It won't. She could either do lukewarm water or whatever and soak it, and then I'll send. It's a half a cup of honey, one
mm-hmm.
teaspoon, 1 to 2 teaspoons of turmeric, and ginger, and cinnamon. 1 to 2 teaspoons of each. And then a teaspoon of vanilla.
Yeah,
and that's
take a snapshot and share it with me. I don't know that I'm going to remember that. I'm
oh,
in
fine.
The middle of doing something. I don't have anything. I'm writing.
But yeah, that's
yeah.
all. And don't refrigerate it.
Mm-hmm.
My son said it tastes like paste when you refrigerate it because the honey gets too cold. So.
Uh-huh.
I made it, I've adjusted it, because he doesn't like cinnamon, so I put a hair less cinnamon and a little bit more ginger and stuff in it,
right.
just to balance out the flavor for him, and he's fine with it. But he said leave it out, because it tastes like paste.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. But, anyway, so head injuries can be soft tissue injuries, the brain, scalp, and then the blood vessels. Or bony injuries
right.
like the skull and your facial bones. Damage is usually caused by direct impact, such as a laceration in the scalp or a fracture of your skull, which is a part of your brain, the part of the skull that has your brain. Anyone with a traumatic injury to the head must always be observed closely, as symptoms may take time to develop. And don't forget, you have the different lobes of the brain. And which what we've talked about before, your occipital lobe is in the very back of the brain. Or so is your brain stem and everything else. But your occipital lobe is where you get your vision, which is also why when people get whiplash, if they hit the head on the front or even the back, your brain, it, even though it's floating in, and it's got liquid or fluid in your brain, around the brain to help cushion it, it could still get bruised. And it's called the contra-coup injury, where the brain will bounce back and forth. So you can actually bruise your frontal lobe and your occipital lobe. And that's like when I had my major accident. My head was split open on the front, but I hit the steering wheel and then hit the door, and my vision was off for weeks until the bruise on the back of my head went away. So always watch out, and that's why you always have to watch out for anybody with a concussion and things like that, because just say you fall and hit your head or anything like that. Like my children's aunt, she fell down a couple steps in the basement, hit her head. Well, she started complaining of a migraine. They went, sent her to the ER, and the doctor's like, oh, it's just a migraine, and they sent her home. Less than 24 hours, I would say it was less than 12 hours, actually, she was back in the hospital on a vent and died the next day because she ended up with an aneurysm. And they never did an MRI, they never did a CAT scan, nothing. So just because, and then she went into respiratory distress. Henceforth, here's what I'm saying, watch out if you hit the back of your head. Okay, so the brain requires blood and oxygen to function normally, and a traumatic brain injury or a TBI, and I used to think only veterans or active duty got TBIs. Anybody can get a TBI. A concussion is considered a TBI. And when they did all my stuff, they found out, yeah, I've had 11 of them. So that's why my doctor's always concerned with my blood pressure, too, with TBI. So that, and the TBS can cause bleeding or swelling inside the skull, and it may increase the intracranial pressure. And this causes the heart to work harder and to get blood and oxygen into the brain. A hematoma, which is basically, it's just a blood clot, could occur within the brain tissue or between the layers of the tissue covering the brain. Pressure that is high enough could actually cause a portion of the brain to push downward through the base of the skull, and that's a brain herniation. So also depending on where the contusion's at. If it's on the top of the skull, it could push your brain down. You can get it on the side and push it to one side or the other. I mean, it can actually go any direction. So without modern medical care, this is most invariably leads to death. Most head injuries result in only a laceration to the scalp and at the site of the impact. Your head's very vascular, if you guys haven't noticed. Any cut to the head, and you think you're going to bleed to death just because it's highly vascular. Most head injuries only result in a laceration to the scalp and swelling at the site of impact. Cuts on the scalp or face bleed heavily, as there, like I said, there are many blood vessels, and that, because that's what helps get the oxygenated blood. And anytime you have a lack of oxygen, your body's going to send the blood to the most important areas, your brain, your heart, your lungs. You know, the most important organs are always where everything's going to go to protect it. This bleeding does not have to signify internal damage. Most cases can be treated as any other laceration. And there's a number of signs and symptoms, like I said. So anytime you have a head injury, check for the level of consciousness of the person. Do they know who they are, where they're at? Are they awake? Are their eyes, just because your eyes are open don't mean crap. Because you can have a blank stare and have a head injury. So that doesn't mean that you're really, you're conscious. if they have seizures, if you have a worsening headache, nausea, vomiting, bruising around your eyes and ears, which is called the raccoon sign, and you'll notice you have two big black eyes. So, or sometimes you can also have a panda eye, which is just one black eye. Bleeding or fluid leakage from the ears and nose. You can either have blood or clear fluid coming out of the ears, and that's the fluid from the brain, around the brain. They can also be confused or very drowsy. One pupil can be more dilated than the other, which means it's a nerve compression, and that's why you'll see that all medical professionals have a little pen light, or it doesn't. You can even use your phone to do the same thing, and they'll check your pupils. So when everybody should know this, when light hits your eye, your pupil will shrink because it eats less light, so that's why it shrinks up. Well, when it's dark or darker, your pupils will dilate and they'll open. So you'll notice also when they say the pupils are fixed and dilated or blown or whatever, that's serious head trauma is what they're referring to. So a concussion is a head injury that results in changes in brain function. Even for a very short period of time, but it doesn't necessarily include loss of consciousness. Like I said, you can have any of those signs or all of them. No two concussions are the same. I don't know if you guys have had concussions, whiplash, crap like that. If you notice, each one will be different. Or they can all be the same. It all depends on you. So if brief loss of consciousness does occur, the patient will usually awaken somewhat foggy. Kind of like if you took a short power nap and you're like really, you're still tired when you wake up. It's kind of the same thing. And it may be unclear as to how the injury occurred or the event shortly before or after. Unless it's a car accident or something like that. Well, yeah, I had a car accident. Now, if somebody comes up from behind him and hits him in the head with a 2x4 or a baseball bat, and of course they're not going to know what happened. They're just going to know that they were awake 1 second, and then, boom, on the ground the next. So just ask them, you know, if they can kind of, you know, say what happened. If not, don't worry about it. I highly doubt they'll get amnesia from it. But severe brain injuries, this, they can get amnesia, and that could be short-term or long-term or even permanent, depending on how bad it is. Like I said, the effects are usually temporary, but like I said, it could be headaches, which is the most common thing. You can also get ringing in the ears, problems with concentration, memory, and balance and coordination. So, and they also may be sluggish or tired. If the person is dizzy or if they have, like, they're really off balance, don't let them walk. Or if it's you, don't walk. Sit down and just wait until you could get your bearings. And if you're outside, find a stick or something to use as a crutch or something, or a walking stick or something to help you walk with. Or if there's someone with you, have them help you walk for a little while until you could get going. It's important to be certain that the patient, once awake, has regained normal motor function. So in other words, make sure they can move all of their extremities. If you can't use one leg, then there's no point in making them walk. You probably got to carry them out, or if they're in the woods or somewhere. If you're at home, there's no point in getting up. Just sit. Unless if it's severe, call 911 and have an ambulance come and pick you up and take you to the hospital. So there are times where you can just wait, you know, and see what happens. And if you're not feeling any better, then yes, go to the hospital. But for the most part, depending on how hard you hit your head and your symptoms, you may not have to go to the hospital. Blah, 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 blah. So even so, rest is prescribed for a day or two, and that should be closely watched. I would say especially so in children, because they have an on and off switch. It's either run and play or sleep. They don't have, or for the all the kids I've ever seen, they don't have that happy. They don't have that gray area. It's either full on play or I'm gonna sit and watch cartoons or go to bed. So with an adult, you know, at least you could keep an adult occupied to sit down or lay down, elevate your feet depending on whatever it is. You know, so it is okay to let the person get some sleep. Once asleep, it might be appropriate to awaken them every couple hours to make sure they could be aroused and have developed none of the danger signals that we were talking about. Now, just say, and that's for the first day. After that, you really don't have to, but the main thing is, you don't need to really completely wake them up. Just say, you know, call their name, touch them. You know what I'm saying? Depending on, not everybody can be touched to wake them up. Just long as they say what or some kind of response to you that you know, okay, they can go back to bed. You know what I'm saying? I don't know about you guys. Are you guys like heavy sleepers to begin with? Where it's like an act of God to wake you up?
Nope.
I wouldn't say I'm a light every sound wakes me up, but I'm not a heavy sleeper either.
Yeah, the only way I'm a heavy sleeper is if I take my my melatonin, and then I'm like catatonic. If I take trazodone now, if I take what they gave me, I'm like the house could be on fire. I might wake up. But you would have to sit there and yell and scream and say, hey, get your ass out of the house. But yeah, I mean, so it all depends on each person. So it's also good to know how they are. So, Bobby, are you a light sleeper or a heavy sleeper?
Pretty light. Very light.
So a fleek and fart, you wake up?
Yep.
I know. And see, I'm getting like my dog. I could hear when we had mice. We used to have mice. And I could hear one in the kitchen. I'm like, damn it. I know that's what that is. And I would get up. And the dogs would bolt to the kitchen. I could hear a noise outside. And I'm up. But considering the fact of what's going on in my surroundings right now, I don't sleep very heavy anyway, and especially at night. During the day, I could take a nap and I'm fine, but it's at night. I don't know why I don't sleep very, very, very well. So in most cases, a concussion causes no permanent damage if further trauma is avoided. So the more concussions / TBIs you have, the more you need to watch out. Try not to hit your head. That's what my doctor told me. Try not to hit your head. I'm like, doc, I had no control over any of those. Being punched in the head a couple times, you really can't help that. But, yeah, he used to joke with me that he was going to give me a helmet to wear. And I'm like, no, thanks. I'm good. So multiple episodes of head trauma over time, however, as in the case of boxers, athletes, soldiers, and things like that, run the higher risk of multiple horseback riders, cowboys, rodeos, you know, all of that stuff, because they get chucked. And so, which can lead to long-term brain damage, so which could be memory deficits, personality changes, sleep disturbance, seizures, psychological problems such as depression, disorders of taste and smell, sensitivity to light and noise. With myself, I've got them all, except for seizures. Well, on the depression, I've always got depression. It doesn't matter. My life's depressing anyway. But yeah, it's your brain, guy. Try not to get knocked around. So if the period of unconsciousness is more than 10 minutes in length, you must suspect the possibility of a significant injury. So check vital signs such as your heart rate, your respiration rate, and blood pressure should be monitored closely. And the patient's head should be immobilized in case there's damage to the spine. That's why you wear the neck braces. So unless it's a severe car accident, or like if you got your bell rung really hard by whatever, go to the hospital. But I mean, if you like some people have like walked into a wall or hit the cabinet in your house or whatever, you don't necessarily have to go to the hospital, but it all depends on you. So just use your head, but use common sense. Okay, sprains and strains. Bones, joints, muscles, and tendons give the body support and locomotion, and there's no substitute for having all your parts in good working order. If you're in the military or were, you know there's no such thing as a perfectly preserved body when you get out. And if you do, then you did supply or some other stupid job. I'm just kidding. Than you did in the ruck marches or heavy lifting or anything like that. So the amount of work these structures will be called upon to do after disaster will be greatly increased. Therefore, the medic will expect to see more injuries, and it's important to know how to identify and treat these problems. Okay, so we're going to see how much everybody remembers or knows from health class. So many people have heard of ligaments, tendons, sprains, strains, but have little idea of what they really are. So everybody knows a joint, not what you smoke, is the physical point of connection between two bones, usually enabling a range of motion, for example, the knee or elbow joint, okay, your shoulder. You know, those are all joints where two bones come together. Ligament is the fibrous tissue that connects one bone to another and often across a joint. So like your Achilles tendon on the back of your heel, that one right there. If that one ruptures, you're kind of screwed, and you won't be able to walk for anything. A tendon is tissue that extends from muscle to connect to the bone. So you get your tendons connect muscle to bone. And a sprain is an injury where the ligament is excessively stretched by forcing a joint beyond its normal range of motion. So runners, it doesn't matter, hiking, running, walking, just say you step in a hole, you step on a rock or whatever, and your ankle gives out, right? And your whole leg goes, your foot goes to the side. So that's forcing your ankle joint to hyperextend farther than what it's supposed to. And that's a sprain. A strain is when the muscle or its connection to the bone is partially torn as a result of an injury. So a lot of weightlifters, athletes, anybody could get a strain, don't get me wrong. But they're more more apt to get them because of what they do. And a rupture is a complete tear through a ligament or muscle. You can also rupture a disc. You could rupture your meniscus, all of those in your knee. That it's just one big mess if you rupture stuff. So sprains, our joints are truly marvels of engineering. They help provide mobility and locomotion and sometimes bear an incredible amount of stress. without mishap. Hopefully that's the way things work. So they're moving parts. However, moving parts wear down. The older you are, natural wear and tear, same thing on your automobile, your brakes, and all that stuff. Same thing. It's just natural wear and tear. In a disaster, our level of physical exertion may increase, and the risk of injury to your joints increase as well. So you can expect the most common sprains in your group to involve the ankle, the wrist, the knee, the finger. But there's also back strain. You can strain your back, especially if you don't lift up whatever it is that you're trying to lift up properly. Or you can even injure your back by falling or something else. So just remember RICE. Rest, ice, compress, and elevate. That's the military's favorite word. Here's a bowl of rice and your Motrin and some water. And we used to joke about it, and people are like, a bowl of rice? What? It's rest, ice, compress, and elevate. So you rest, especially the joint or whatever area of the body it is. If you can't just rest the back of the arm, you can still walk, but rest. Cold therapy decreases both the swelling and the pain. The earlier it is applied, the more likely to speed up the healing process. If you're in the wilderness, have instant cold packs in your backpack, and just in case, because ice will not be available. Cold therapy should be performed several times a day for 20 to 30 minutes out for the first 24 to 48 hours. Never apply ice directly to the skin. And that means even the ice, the compress. Well, there's a bag around it. No, that's not what I mean. Use a washcloth, a T-shirt, a towel, something to keep, because you can still cause a cold injury. I don't want to say frostbite, but, you know, you can cause irritation to your skin from the ice pack. So just put something there. Compression. A compression bandage is useful to decrease swelling and should be applied after each cold therapy. ACE wraps, I don't know if you guys, I'm sure you guys have heard of the Copper Fit. They have compression hose. They've got the sleeves for your arm, for your knee, your ankle. I mean, they got all that stuff. If you're using an ACE wrap, it's important to remember that to take two of your fingers, and after it's been applied, put both your fingers underneath the wrap. If you can't just easily put your fingers under there, it's too tight. You don't want to cut off circulation.
I have trigger finger. My one hand, I've been having problems with trigger finger. I've been using an ACE bandage, you know. But you're right. They recommend doing it like at night when you're sleeping. And you have to be very careful that it's not too tight, or, you know, it can cut off your circulation.
Yeah, I have two wrist braces that have the metal bar on the top and bottom, and they're ambidextrous, so you can actually flip it over, and you can actually use it on either hand. The cool thing is,
I have those for my wrist. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's Velcro, but you could still put that on too tight. So your braces, they say, and then I have two knee braces. I have a tennis elbow brace. Dude, I am so broken.
Ooh,
I've got braces for everything.
You got some issues. I do have issues,
but guess what? but the good thing is I know when to wear it. If I over exhaust myself, yes, I'll put that brace on, but here's the good thing. All I got to do is wear it for an hour or two, and then I can take it off.
Yeah,
so
the brace that I have for, like, my wrists, because I get, because of the way I hold the phone and typing on a keyboard constantly, especially my right wrist, I do. Like you said, you have to be careful not to put it on too tight, and I try not to wear it more than an hour, two max. It depends on what I'm doing. And,
here's something else.
But, it helps. It helps. It does definitely help.
If you're going to use physical exertion, wear your brace.
Right.
Because it'll help with support. And then you can take it off afterwards. Now I've had where they told me for my shoulder and back, use a heating pad and an ice pack. I alternate. I forget which one it was, the heat first, the cold first, I can't remember. And then that's it. The heat will loosen you up. Actually, I think the heat first, because it loosens up. And then the ice for the swelling and the pain.
Well, it depends on what's the problem. Sometimes you do the ice first.
True. But, no, mine's for my back, the heat. And I've got the heat. Well, the only reason why I've got two braces, honest to God, is because my damn dog chewed one of the little plastic things where you put the Velcro through on the top and bottom.
Uh-huh.
This has three Velcro straps. Well, little shit, she chewed it, so I had to get another one, and the little bitch chewed the other one. So now I've got two braces, and I only have that, but it's got the big middle one. I don't really need the top or bottom straps, so I just cut them off. And then, but here's the thing. And my doctor gave me two knee braces because she didn't want me to overcompensate with my right knee because of my left knee. So she wanted me to wear a brace on each knee at the same time. I'm like, no, I'm not doing that shit. So, but I still have two knee braces. But my knee freezes. It feels like it freezes up and locks up. But it's not hurting the way it used to. So I wear it whenever it just starts to hurt. Weather change, rain, things like that. So you'll get to know your body. Especially once you've got an injury, that's it. You're marked for arthritis for the rest of your life. Anyway, elevation. Elevate the sprain above the level of the heart. Well, hello, guess what? Unless it's your arm, you're not going to walk around with your arm above your head. So if you're sitting in your chair, just elevate your arm. You can rest it on a pillow. Put it in a sling. The thing is, you still want to use the joint. You don't want to immobilize it because guess what's going to happen? You will lock that bad boy up and the ligaments and tendons and the muscles will get stiff, and then you're going to be in a bigger problem than what you were to begin with. That's why doctors they don't really care for them, the braces and wraps, after the first 48 to 72 hours. They want them off and just use when you're sleeping or if you're doing something that can aggravate that injury even more. Now, some people have to wear support on their ankles or their knees because they are weak. I had to when my daughter was two, she's 32 now, so 30 years ago, they used to have carpeted stairs, I swear to God, up north. It was a big thing. You carpet your stairs. And she decided that she did not want me to carry her down the stairs, and she jumped out of my arms on the last step. And my foot slipped. And I landed full body weight on my ankle sideways. And I heard a pop, and we thought I broke my ankle. And back in the day, I wore high tops. And the biggest mistake I made was taking off the high top. Because as soon as I did, my ankle swelled up the size of a grapefruit. And it took...
Yeah, you couldn't get it back on, I'm sure.
Oh, hell no. Oh, no. With my nephew, I should still say he's my nephew. It's my kid's cousin, my ex-husband's nephew. He was screaming and crying because he was five or six, and he was traumatized. I don't know. just because of what happened and all this. And I'm just calmly sitting down in the corner. And a fire department got, I mean, the EMS got there, and they thought it was him. They're like, no, it's me. And I'm just sitting here, and I had to have an air cap or an air boot put on. And it's got the hard plastic with the air cushion on each side. You have the thing on each side of your ankle. Well, I wore that. But the problem is they didn't treat it. And this is why I say pay attention to your body, guys. They're like, okay, 6 weeks, you know, this is back in the day. Stay off your foot for about a week and then wear the brace and then go on. And it was like 6 weeks later and nothing. Okay. But I would constantly, I could be walking on flat ground. If I didn't have the right shoes on, my ankle would give and I'd sprain my ankle. I think I have sprained my ankle probably about 50 times, my right one, until I got into nursing, and it was about maybe 7 years in, and I used to work at orthopedic hospital, and he had to cut the ligaments and tendons and shorten them because I stretched them out so bad. So pay attention to your injuries. I know, especially if you're athletes or stuff like that, you know, surgery means you're done or you're going to be out for the season or it could be your job. You only have one body. Now, I'm not saying treat it like, well, you should, you know, it's God's temple, but that's beside the point. I don't mean not use your body, but you got to take care of it. You've got one body. You got two arms, two legs, 2 feet, two hands. That's it.
I need a new one.
I need a new one too. And I'm like, I want a refund.
Yeah, like, me too.
But here's the thing, especially your legs and your feet. That's what gets you around. You can get through life with, one arm or one and a half or whatever, even if you have both arms, but one's kind of useless. Like, I've got permanent nerve damage, but guess what? Dry needling, fix that shit. So now I've got almost full use of my right arm, but you don't need your arms to walk around. You need your feet, which is why I'm saying this. Protect your legs. Also your back. Your back is really important to, anywho. So by elevating the leg, it helps the inflammatory fluid process back into your circulation. Also, that's with, like, compression hose. Especially if someone has congestive heart failure, you wear those compression hose, TED hose, whatever you want to call them. It helps push the fluid back up into the body so your kidneys can pump it and circulate it, and you're good back in business. It also works for swollen ankles, like I said, to chronic medical problems. Also high blood pressure, pregnant women, diabetics, I mean, anything. If you see your foot swollen, you know what? Even insect stings, thing where you might have got bit and your foot swells, drop it up. And so basically the best thing for you is you don't have to lay down on your couch per se, like sit up in the corner and just elevate your foot on one or two cushions. Just that much, or a pillow, whatever you have, at a 45-degree angle if you want. That's pretty good. And the fluid will come down. So stabilization is immobilizing the injury. It will prevent further damage. And this can be accomplished by a compression bandage alone or a splint or a cast. Casts are usually broken bones, but they can also be if you ruptured something and it needs to be completely immobilized. So God, I have no idea what they do for a ruptured Achilles heel. I have no idea. I've actually never come across anybody with that kind of injury. I would say probably surgery to fix that. So splints can be commercially produced, such as a SAM splint. And a SAM splint, I don't know if you guys know what this is. These are awesome. SAM splints, you can form them into any type of brace you want. And it's a little thin layer of aluminum, not aluminum foil. It's thicker than aluminum foil, but it's stiff. And it's like 4 inches wide and probably maybe a foot or 2 foot long, depending on how big of a package it is. You can make any type of splint with it, and it molds right to your body. But you can also make a splint. You can improvise it with two sticks and a cloth, a shoelace, a belt. Pretty much anything can be improvised into a splint, depending on where you're at. But make sure the injured joint is immobile after placing the placement of the splint. Not to mention, try not to have bare skin if you're going to use an improvised splint. If it's on your leg, make sure you have pants on or a sock or just some material around it, because you don't want to irritate the skin. So how can you tell the difference between a sprain and a fracture? Well, depending on the deformity of it, will tell you if it's a sprain or a fracture. Sometimes it's quite easy, as often as a leg bone or straight bone is suddenly zigzag. If you've seen a complete fracture on a limb, you'll know. Is it an open fracture or closed? Did it tear through the skin? Usually, injury. I doubt a sports injury where the bone will protrude, but it all depends on how it, you know what I'm saying, how hard the hit was, or depending on what sport it is. Because you can break a long bone, your femur, or your the tibia, hell, even the fibia, either one, and it could protrude through your skin. But that would have to be I'm talking like you just hit a brick wall and broke it. But usually car accidents, hiking, if you fall down a flight of stairs, I mean, really serious things will be an open fracture. But a fracture will generally have more pronounced swelling and bruising. And if it's a complete fracture or a good enough fracture, you're not going to be able to walk on it. You're not going to be able to use it. And it will bruise, boom, right away. A fracture is generally so painful that no traction or pressure may be placed on the injury. A fracture may have a deep cut in the area of the injury, and that's called an open fracture, which is particularly dangerous because of the risk of infection or bleeding to death, depending on where it's at. A fracture may show motion in an area beyond the joint. Like if your finger suddenly has 5 knuckles, you probably broke it. Well, your finger only has 2. Now, here's the deal. If you break your toes or your fingers, there's not a damn thing they can do about it. All they're going to do is buddy tape them. Unless you have an orthopedic doctor that does some weird shit, unless you crush it, well, then, yes, they're going to have to put a metal rod there permanently. But for the most part, if you break your fingers or your toes, they're just going to buddy tape it. I have broke the same toe on my right foot 4 times. The same toe. And my big toe, this is why I don't wear flip-flops anymore. And I recommend for anybody who wears flip-flops or sandals or anything like that, make sure you've got good footing, because my foot went all the way forward and my big toe went underneath my foot, and I chipped the bone, and it's just floating in my foot, in my toe. It can never be fixed. So with things like that, and yes, they'll turn, like I said, it'll turn black and blue right away, and it'll swell up. But all they could do is buddy tape them. And sometimes people use popsicle sticks, or you could buy finger splints. I don't think they make toe splints. I just take medical tape and tape the two, the appendage that's right next to it, tape it together, but not too tight. And you use the stability of the toe or finger next to the other one that's broken, and that's it. Now, if it's, but here's the thing. If after a couple of days it's not getting any better, I would go ahead and go to your doctor and have them take a look at it so they can x-ray it. So for sprains, ibuprofen serves both as anti-inflammatory and pain reliever. Most sprains heal over time using the RICE or the rest, ice, compress, and elevate protocol and pain relievers and a lot of rest. Others, however, such as severe knee strains with torn or ruptured ligaments may heal completely only with the aid of a surgical intervention. I have a partial tear in my cartilage. They're not doing surgery. They ain't doing shit. And it's a partial tear. So I don't know about each orthopedic facility, doctor, whatever. They all have their protocols. Some minor or partial tears or ruptures can heal with physical therapy, braces. And they actually have, because I can't take Motrin or any of the NSAIDs, they actually have a cream, the topical cream that's anti-inflammatory, and it works every now and then, but whatever. But it does work. So it's important to get your joint issues dealt with while they still have, will we still have modern medicine to help. If you need surgery to fix a bad knee, do it now. In uncertain times, you and your joints will want to be in the best shape possible because, God forbid, if anything catastrophic happens, you're SOL. So, especially if you have a hip fracture. Because I'm telling you, 9 times out of 10, a hip fracture, probably 10 out of 10, a hip fracture has to have surgery to fix it. Or it will heal wrong and you walking funny. So strains, by far, the most frequently strained will be to the back muscle. I don't know if you guys have heard. Gunny. What the hell is his name? He's the Marine. I forgot what his name is, though. Lee Remy. Isn't it what his name is, Bobby?
Pretty Bear.
Who?
Isn't it Lee Remy? Gunny? The Marine. You know what I'm talking about? He had that. I believe it was him that had the saying, use your back muscle. It's the strongest muscle in the body. No.
Yeah.
It's a joke. It's bullshit. Do not do that.
Right.
Believe it or not, shoveling snow causes more back problems for everybody. I don't care what age you are.
They tell me about it.
Yeah, and it
because
also,
they don't
believe it
exactly.
Well, not only that, it depends on how much snow you have
true.
To, but it, you can also have a heart attack shoveling snow. We had a lot of heart attack victims come in during the wintertime. But the one good thing, if you get a lot of foot, then again, you probably know what to do anyway. And we put down a lot of salt before it snows, the rock salt, not table salt. That works for a little while, but I use rock salt before it really snowed or iced, and you didn't have to worry about it. Even young people have issues shoveling snow, believe it or not.
And it depends on if it's heavy snow.
Oh, true. Yeah, there's the light, fluffy snow, and there's packing snow.
Yeah.
That wet snow, man, it makes good snowballs. It's great for sledding. Bad for your back, which is why
I've
they invented snowballs.
I've shoveled snow where the snow actually looked blue because it was that wet.
Oh yeah, I wouldn't doubt it. And I didn't shovel snow until it was done. I'm like, screw this shit. I am not going to keep going out there.
Well, that's fine too. But if you're getting 12 inches of snow and trying to shovel that all at once, that's worse than your back than just doing a little bit at a time.
That's true. True. It like I said, it all depends on what kind of snow. If it's heavy packing snow, you're not going to want to shovel it while it's, you know, all of it. But like I said,
right.
Snowplows, and, you know, not the ones for you, not the ones for the road. I'm talking about for your sidewalks and all that shit. So, as the lower part of the back holds the majority of the body's weight, you can expect the most trouble. Also, like Lorna, like you were saying, your friends that have the ankylosing spondylosis, I have
mm-hmm.
that. And the very bottom of my spine is twisted just a little bit. I was born with it and had no idea. The Army did not find it until after I got out.
Well, it's kind of funny they just found that out now that he's in the hospital with COVID pneumonia.
Unless they did an X-ray or an MRI, they're not going to know.
They haven't
been able to. See,
that's the other thing. They haven't been able to do any of that because he's too sick.
I don't know how they found out. The only way you're going to know you got ankylosing spondylosis is if you do a friggin' X-ray of the spine or an MRI. It's the only way you're going to
know.
So I have about 15 minutes of I can either vacuum the carpet or, I mean, I push through. After about 15 minutes, my lower back starts to hurt immensely where I can hardly move. And then I just put a heating pad on my back for like 15, 20 minutes. Boom, I'm good to go. Because that's what kind of problems it causes. So every morning you should perform one, stretching to increase the blood flow to cold, stiff muscles and joints. When you lift a heavy object, such as a backpack, a rucksack, a case of water, anything heavy, keep your back straight and let your legs perform the work. Also, whatever you're carrying, carry it close to your body, to the closer to the center of gravity so you don't strain your back. Also, lift with your legs, not your back. And also, use two people. If you know for a fact you can't lift something, a heavy log, a heavy box, or a TV, I don't care, furniture, whatever, have two people. Don't be so proud that you're going to do it yourself and then, you know, jack yourself up and then you're screwed. Keep the weight on the hips rather than the shoulders. If you're on a rocky, unstable terrain, consider using a walking stick for balance. Walking sticks are awesome. It's a third leg, pretty much. And they're great, especially if you're accident prone and you're clumsy. They're great to have walking sticks, period. Remember, any weightlifting action that you perform while being off balance is likely to result in a strained muscle, especially your back. Moist heat therapy seems to be effective for relief from back strains. Ibuprofen is an excellent anti-inflammatory, which is ibuprofen, Motrin, and Advil, all the same product. Also, Flexeril. Okay, now here's the thing about Flexeril. Flexeril is a muscle relaxer. I don't know about you guys. It works best only on my back. For some people, Flexeril is only good for lower back muscle problems. I mean, I don't know what other joints that they can give to you for any muscle problems or whatever, but for the most part, Flexeril works great on your back. Um, Also, it says if any of those are not available, puncture, massage therapy, traction, or traction to your spine. I mean, if your back's out of alignment, I mean, it may help your back. I don't know. But stuff like stretching, if you have access to a hot tub, the jets work really great, and things like that. So common herbal pain relievers for orthopedic injuries include direct application of oils like wintergreen, peppermint, clove, or diluted arnica to the affected area. Blends of these oils may also be used, so you can blend it. Like, a lot of things works great by itself, but as we've discussed, that combining certain things, one item will enhance the other one and make it even better. So some sprains and strains heal well over time with therapy, just with some of the stuff we've discussed. Other injuries may cause chronic pain and eventual degeneration of the joint, and it'll be difficult to foretell the progress of it, which is why if you do not treat a sprain or strain or any injury to a ligament, tendon, bone, whatever, you will end up with arthritis. Well, arthritis is just bones anyway. So the longer you prolong treatment, you're running the risk of arthritis. So, okay. A dislocation is an injury in which the bone is pulled out of joint by some type of trauma. You can dislocate your fingers, your toes, your shoulder, your hip, and things like that. Ankles. But no, hold on a second. Dislocations commonly occur in shoulders, fingers, and elbows. But knees, ankles, and hips. Okay, they can also say, I've dislocated my hip all the time. My hip pops out. It's not hard. And so the way I put mine back in is all I got to do is put pressure on it against a wall or something, and it pops back in. Hurts like a son of a bitch. Same thing with a dislocated shoulder. You can put it right back in. Yes, it's going to hurt when you put a joint back together when it's dislocated. It's going to hurt for a minute or so. It actually hurts more when it's while it's dislocated and not put back straight. So a subluxation occurs when a dislocation is momentary and the bone slips back into its joint spontaneously. So subluxations can be treated the same way that sprains are, using rice. And if the subluxations are different than chiropractors, because chiropractors do not pull your joints and then let them back in. So, of course, if there is medical care readily available, the patient should go directly to the ER. General anesthesia is often used to resolve the problem. Oh, that's if it's really bad. My kid's dad was playing football. I swear to God, he's ding-toed. They call it ding-toed, where, I don't know what you guys call it, but his feet go in. Instead of, they're not straight. His feet actually curve inward.
Pigeon-toed.
Pigeon-toed, ding-toed. Yeah, I guess it depends on the area, because he was up north in New England. They call it ding-toed, but it is pigeon-toed. My son, because of the way he sat in utero, his legs were crossed, and his feet were curved in. And so after he was born, I would actually take it and have to hold his feet outward for like 10, 15 seconds and then straighten them and then keep doing it, and his straightened out. But my ex-husband's a dumbass, and apparently they never fixed that problem. And he tripped over his own feet when he played football. which is the reason why he had a mess up. Okay, well, when they were playing football, he got, this is so bad, he was running, he had the ball, he was running with it, and he got tackled from behind. Well, his foot planted into the ground, right? It did not move, but his body kept going. Okay, he completely separated his ankle. Like, if you took his foot and pulled it and then moved it to the outside of his leg. As if you were to chop his foot off and just sit it next to his ankle. That's what his ankle did. Completely separated, and it was just flopping around. They didn't know what to do with the EMS and all this. They just braced his foot, with they wrapped it and stuff, and they had to cut his sneaker off. Do you know how they fixed it? I kid you not. The doctor took his big toe and gently pulled from his ankle and pulled it out, and it popped it back into place. Of course, he had to have two steel pins put in his ankle because it did that. So stuff like that, yes, it has to have surgery when it's dislocated. That's complete. His leg right in half, the bone right in half. And he had to have a steel rod and screws, plate, and everything. And it was with everybody from work. So they were like, what can they say? But anyway, so yeah, you guys could just watch out when you're playing sports, any contact, anything, or whatever, because shit like that can happen. And let me tell you something, it's a year of physical therapy afterwards. If you have to have surgery, you're looking at a year minimum, physical therapy, or any type of rehab, anything like that. So, yeah. So, of course, if you're off the grid, however, you will probably have to correct the dislocation yourself, and it's called reduction. And something like that. Who's this? On the lot. Okay.
Is that
so not only
Phil?
Is that Phil? Is that Dr.
Yes.
Phil? Or is it some?
Hello, everybody.
Hi.
I'm banging around and making all kinds of noise. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. We just play the guessing game. So not only does reducing the dislocation decrease the pain experienced by the victim, but if performed correctly, will lessen the damage to all the blood vessels and nerves that run along the injury. Expect significant pain on the part of the patient during the actual procedure. Like I said, yeah, it hurts to put a joint back. Prescription pain relaxers like Flexeril can also be helpful, but most of the time you're probably going to get some, you might, I don't know, depending on your doctor, get some good pain reliever. The use of traction will greatly aid your attempt to fix the problem. Traction is the act of pulling the dislocated bone away from the joint to give the bone room to slip back into place. With every elderly patient, actually any patient we had who had a hip fracture, we put them in traction where they're in bed. And then we have the little weight and the, give a brace around the leg, and it gently pulls the hip to keep it aligned because they didn't always get into surgery right away. So. Oh, we got plenty of time to do fractures. So if enough force is applied, an injury to soft tissue can damage the skeletal structure underneath. When a bone is broken, it's called a fracture. But there are several types of fractures. But for our purpose, let's assume that they're either open or closed. A closed fracture is when there's a break in the bone, but the skin is intact. In open fractures, the skin is pierced by the broken bone, or it could have been pierced by whatever broke the bone and then caused it to be an open fracture. So in open fractures, the skin is pierced by the broken bone, or if there's some other penetrating trauma, the end of the bone may be above or below the level of the skin. Needless to say, there's usually more blood loss and infection associated with an open wound, and the infection may be deep in the skin or the blood or the bone itself, and could be life-threatening if not treated. If poorly managed, a closed fracture can become an open fracture, like if you try to walk on it or use your arm, and then it could become an open fracture. So the diagnosis of a broken bone can be simple, as when the bone is obviously deformed or difficult, or as in a minimal hairline fracture, x-ray is usually how they check it and find out. Dealing with a fractured bone involves first evaluating the injured area, using EMT scissors to cut away the clothing. If you don't have EMT scissors, any scissors will do. Just try not to poke the person. Trauma shears have the blunt on the bottom, the blunt end. It's round, and it just helps so you don't cut the person. So you use the scissors to cut away the clothing over the injury, and this will prevent further injury that may occur if the patient is made to... Sorry, my dog's being retarded. I could never get through a whole show without this retard wanting something. Oh, be quiet. Okay. Anywho. I lost my place. Okay, so check the site for bleeding and the presence of an open wound. If present, stop the bleeding before proceeding any further. Fractures may also cause damage to the patient's circulation in the limb. So check for pulses, the distal pulses, away from, just to make sure. Because it can tear your vessels, and hopefully not an artery, but especially even if it's a closed fracture. Okay, so... Dang, gone. I need either new glasses or more lighting. So it's important to check the area beyond the level of the injury. Water blue instead of normal skin color. And for strong pulses, strong and steady ones, unless you don't want to hear that. If you have to really feel for a pulse and you could barely feel it, that's not good. Circulation is being cut off. Usually normal skin color returns to the skin and the fingertips within 2 seconds. And that's, you know, how you take it and you push on the fingernail and it'll blanch white and then it turns back to pink or whatever color. To find out what a strong pulse feels like, place 2 fingers on the side of your neck. Don't push hard and don't use your thumb. Use your two fingers. And just, you can feel. You can feel your carotid, or you can feel the pulse on your wrist by your thumb. That's why they always tell anyone never use your thumb to check a pulse, because you end up feeling yours instead of theirs. Okay. So if the patient has broke his or her arm, lightly prick the patient in the same area with a toothpick to make sure they have normal sensation. So, yeah, you can use anything to check to make sure that the nerves haven't been damaged. If the bone has not been deformed to the extremity, a simple splint will immobilize the fracture, prevent further injury to soft tissue, and promote appropriate healing. But that's why it's important to get an x-ray. Because if you have a fracture, the bone, if you don't set it, it'll deform. It'll be deformed when it heals. And then in some instances, they have to actually re-break it to set it. Come on, dog. sorry. He's just going to stand here and look at me like I'm retarded. Never mind. He's staying outside. Okay. So, yes, if you have a fracture, it could be a hairline fracture. And, you know, honestly, one of the ways when they also tell, like, especially for child abuse, they have spiral fractures, complete fractures, open, closed. Shit, I can't think of how many other fractures there are. The spiral fracture is like, actually, you know, when you, and this is why they say about child abuse, it's like someone took both of your hands and twisted the person's arm or leg or whatever. Usually it's the arm of the child. That's how they can tell. But that's what spiral is. Sue, what are the kind of, I'm drawing a blank on the types of fractures. Compound, spiral, complete, hairline, open, close. Is there any more?
Compound.
Yoo-hoo.
A compound fracture? A compound fracture?
Compound fracture. Hold on, let me look it up, because I forgot. Like I said, if you don't use all your medical knowledge.
Is the worst. That's the one, I think, where your bone splits and sticks out your skin.
No, that's an open fracture.
Oh. Because I thought the compound fracture was a clean break.
Well,
I think you're
right. You know what? Hold on. Maybe. If I could get back to my... Okay. Everybody knows what a hairline fracture is.
Yes.
And those are hard... Huh?
I said that's the most common, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, not necessarily most common, but you do see a lot of those. Come on. My internet is like... Oh, you know what? Screw you. My internet connection was interrupted. Ah, okay. No, we are wrong. There's... Holy crap. I did not realize there was that many. See how many I forgot. There is. Come on. Okay. So there's a traverse fracture, which means it goes... straight across the bone, right? A linear fracture is when it goes up and down the bone. An oblique non-displaced is if it goes, like, at an angle downward. Oblique displaced means they completely snapped it in half at an angle. The spiral is, like I said, if it looks, you could tell it was twisted. A comminuted... And it a comminuted looks like you just, if you rammed, I would say if you, say you fell from a high distance, from a high, like from what first floor, second floor to the first floor, and when you land, it's like when you ram the bone together, that's what it looks like. And then the green stick, I can't remember what a green stick is. I think it's just what it's on the side.
It's a buccal fracture.
Which one?
A green stick is a buccal fracture. It's where part of the bone breaks, but the other part kind of just bends a little bit. It kind of buckles.
Okay. Oh, yep, that's what they call it here. See, now they got avulsion fracture is when a fragment of bone is separated from the main. See, now this has different, this is the 10 most common types.
Yeah. An avulsion is usually associated when a tendon, you know, a tendon's attached to bones. Well, when the piece of the bone breaks off, for example, on the front of your knee, you got something called the tibial tuberosity, and the patella tendon attaches there. Some guys who fall down on their knees, that little piece of bone will break, and the tendon will pull back. So they'll see a bone fragment separated from the main bone, and they call that an avulsion fracture. But it's usually tied to a tendon when it avulses. Yeah. people with Osgood Slaughter, they have a pronounced tibial tuberosity, which means a bigger little knot on the front of the knee, and they're at risk for falling down and fracturing that tibial tuberosity and separating their patella.
Oh, okay.
That's
interesting.
There's a lot of did you talk about the fractures in kids? They classify them the Salter-Harris classification.
The what?
Yeah. Well,
I know the spinal fracture is usually...
Yeah, well, okay. Well, fracture in children is a little bit more significant because the children have their growth plates attached to the end of their bones and they're still growing. So they have five different classifications for children's types of fractures, and they classify them by the Salter-Harris classification, 1 through 5. Similar to adults, but the significance is the higher the number, the higher the chances for a long-term deformity with the child. As they continue to grow, their growth plates aren't closed yet, and so the fracture can create a deformity depending on the type of fracture. So kids' fractures are a lot more significant than adults, but also kids' bones are a lot harder to fracture, except for maybe, you know, like at the wrist. Yeah, at the wrist, and a lot of times they can pull the shoulder out. Yeah, real easy.
Yeah,
and then what
you're
talking
about?
Supposed
to pick your kids up.
right, by the arms anyway. And then also you were talking about your child being born, you know, with his hip issues, and then they call that a congenital hip dysplasia. And every time your child goes in for his physical exam as a baby, they should be checking for that hip dysplasia by pushing down on the hips and feeling for a click or something that subluxes. Sometimes they miss them.
Yeah, we had to get him the Stride Right shoes back. I don't know if they still make Stride Right shoes.
Well, they still make the braces that will turn the feet straight. Yeah,
that was the last step. We were going to have the braces, but they just told us to get him the Stride Right, and those shoes, they're heavy, but they're completely straight. And he wore them and we had to start before he started walking. And he had no problem. But like I was saying, his dad, on the other hand, they didn't have that stuff back in the day. And so his pigeon toes never got fixed. He still has it to this day. And,
well, you know, when they do knee replacements in the elderly, sometimes if they don't get the bones adjusted just right, you'll also get that pigeon toe deformity. You get the opposite too, where, you know, the feet are on the outward as well. But knee replacements, commonly that happens. You get a torsion between the tibia and the fibula when they do those replacements.
And the other type of fracture is the, hold on a second. The pathological fracture, like osteoporosis, arthritis, osteomyelitis, osteosarcoma, or metabolic bone disorders.
Multiple myeloma as well, Colin Powell.
Okay. So people with other of those issues can also break bones easier, which is why my uncle, he had osteoporosis really bad, and he was getting a lot of vitamin D and calcium and all that stuff, and he said he felt like his body was heavier because he had to strengthen his bones because he broke his back. He actually broke his back and was in a full body cast when he was younger, and after that he just had constant problems with his bones after that. So.
Yeah, that usually that osteoporosis is significant in males that are like 70 or above, but any female postmenopause is at high risk for osteoporosis. And the really main concern we have with the osteoporosis is hip fractures. A simple fall could lead to a pathological fracture, real simple.
Yeah.
And hip fractures are difficult to recover from. Very difficult.
This is one thing that I learned from all the years working in nursing homes. After 70 years old, roughly after 70 years old, if they had a hip fracture, if they were not up and out of bed within the first, you know, I'm talking first month of really making an effort, most of the time the patient died within a year. That's one thing I did notice about every single one of my patients who had a hip fracture. We lost within a year, except one of them. And she was a fighting woman anyway. She had Alzheimer's, and she wandered the halls all the time.
Yeah, my concern with hip fractures is blood clots. Because you know, the pelvis bone is one of the largest marrow containing bones in the body, and it has, you know, a lot of blood forming qualities in it, and fracturing of the hip. Very high risk, and that's why every hip fracture gets put on a Lovenox or some sort of blood thinner for a while.
I broke mine in 5 places.
Huh?
I said I broke mine in 5 places.
Oh, wow.
Did Bobby help you?
Huh?
Did Bobby help you do that?
No, I didn't know him back then.
I went.
Yeah, when did you?
But if
you when did you do that?
When I was 18.
Oh, okay.
Sound like car wreck.
No, I was head on into a dirt bank, going over 100 miles an hour, from what the police had said.
Must have been some good wine.
I fell asleep. My ex-husband was driving.
Oh.
So 70% of all hip fractures in the elderly are from women.
Why?
Huh?
Why? Why?
Osteoporosis. Osteoporosis.
Why? Secondary to
menopause?
What?
Menopause.
Exactly. We call that unopposed estrogen.
Oh, okay. this is an elderly care website, but it says 4 out of 5 people will survive a hip fracture. But like I'm saying, is if they stay in bed and don't get up, that's what happens. They're just like, they gave up. And that's when they start having a lot of other issues. But,
like I was saying, the immobility also leads to blood clots. And a lot of times they'll throw a blood clot and they'll end up with a stroke, an aneurysm, or a heart attack.
Yep. So that's why it's important to the aftercare. Okay.
Yeah.
So we went over the...
Vitamin D and calcium, everybody. Hello. Vitamin D and calcium.
Hello. Yes, sunlight.
Yeah.
Hello. So,
sunlight.
The buddy taping for, like, the fingers and toes, because unless you crush the bone, like I said, they can't fix it.
Yeah. Crush fractures are really, really bad. They're painful, too.
Oh, yeah. They're very painful.
When you were talking about, sorry, just to backtrack a little bit, I was listening to you talking about muscle spasms and Flexeril and things like that, and you're talking about using like ibuprofen, Motrin, and Advil. I just want to let you guys know, you know, if you ever get cramps in your muscles, try magnesium, because magnesium and if you're a premenopausal, you're still having your menstrual cramps, try getting a leaf, which is also known as naproxen. You take 2 over the counter naproxen with a magnesium 500 milligrams, and you're gonna like feel wonderful. I think those.
But what about the potassium too?
Potassium is only important if you're low in potassium. But magnesium and calcium are more important. And most people say, well, eat a banana. Banana does have potassium, but it's a very small amount. It's not a whole lot of potassium.
And I started taking vitamin D6 because I got trigger finger, and I am not getting that damn horse needle again for the cortisone. So I did some research, and they said that magnesium and B deficiency in magnesium and B6 can cause it. So I've taken magnesium because of my immune system too, but I've noticed since I've started taking the B6 and I forget what else they recommended, it actually is improving. A lot of things are improving. And the turmeric is helping too.
Yeah, for trigger finger, a lot of times it's a calcium problem. And if you're taking calcium, you need to be taking a D3 along with your magnesium.
I don't take calcium. I do take D3.
You should probably be taking at least 400 to 800 units of calcium daily, along with the D3 and along with, a magnesium supplement and a B complex. If you're having neuropathy causing the trigger finger, the B complex vitamin is the best way to go because you got your B12 and your B6 in the complex.
I take B6, I take a B super complex, I take 10,000 units of D3, of the magnesium. I'm not doing the calcium. I didn't know about the calcium. I guess I'll have to get that.
Give it a try and see. And you might notice a difference in the trigger finger. A lot of times,
the B6. I also started taking something called biotin.
Biotin is good for your hair and your nails.
I'm trying to go, all natural stuff, and I'm working on reducing my sugars because I know that doesn't help. I've noticed an improvement. My trigger finger is not nearly as bad, nor is my arthritis. So.
Well, if you have issues with your sugars, you might want to consider alpha lipoic acid as well to help you metabolize your sugars better.
I got that. I take a prescription, but my sugars are going down. You need to learn to keep them down without taking man-made medicine.
Colonel, I'm going to put you on the spot. You ready?
Oh, God. Yeah, go ahead.
What is osteoarthritis?
Oh, it's arthritis in your bones.
Yes, absolutely. But do you know it's not considered an inflammatory arthritis. You know that, right?
Yeah.
And
so
why?
Rheumatoid arthritis is. Well, that's related to it, but.
Okay. Well, let me expand everyone's knowledge on osteoarthritis. Osteoarthritis occurs when you do damage to a bone, whether it's from overuse, repetitive use, or even contact, fracture, etc. The reason why that occurs is because all of your bones are coated in something called cartilage. So you have a cartilage coating on your bone. When you do damage to that cartilage, It's like an insulator to the bone. When you do damage to the cartilage, it exposes the bone like an electrical wire. You remove the insulation, the wire is exposed. That can allow oxidation to occur. Well, the body wants to repair itself, so what it does, it starts sending calcium to fix it, but it doesn't repair the cartilage. So now you have little bone spurs developing on areas where the cartilage has been damaged or eroded or wiped off by whatever means. And so now you have these bone spurs affecting the cartilage. Whenever you have osteoarthritis of the knees, it's because the cartilage has worn off so bad where now you have bone on bone, because it also acts as an insulator. So osteoarthritis,
oh, wow,
essentially, osteoarthritis is essentially cartilage damage, which the cartilage protects the bone, and it can be caused by a number of things: direct contact, fracture, overuse, repetitive use, excessive weight bearing. So if they ever tell you you have osteoarthritis, it means that you've damaged the cartilage that protected your bones. And your body's putting, you get bone spurs on your heels, you can get bone spurs in your joints, and those spurs is what creates a lot of the pain. But generally it's not inflammatory until those spurs start poking into things. You start, you know, causing, you know, they can be inflammatory, but in general, old age, arthritis is not, yeah.
I did have bone spur. I did get a bone spur on my heel, on my foot or whatever. But the doctor had me do all this stuff. I mean, he didn't have to like operate or anything. He just had me do these things, and it went away on its own. He said if I didn't take proper care of it, like, you know, supplements, whatever, and that's one of the reasons why I started doing supplements. And I forget stretches or whatever that he had me do, in order to get it to go away, because it was a bone spur. I was like, because I had never heard of it.
Well, yeah, those cortisone shots hurt.
I had the first time I had a trigger finger was in my right hand, and I'm right-handed, and it was, you know, it was causing, you know, some functionality difficulties. It was in my ring finger and my thumb, so I got two shots at the same time. And the doctor was like, if it doesn't work, or you start having, you know, you come back and do it again. And I'm like, I looked at him and I said, no, thank you. Once is enough. And luckily I never had problems with it again. Now I'm having it in my other hand, but they're not sticking that thing in my finger again, ever. I will suffer first.
Well, if you'll remember this, you may have a normal blood calcium level when they do like a metabolic panel on you. Your calcium is probably normal in your blood. But if your vitamin D level is low, then the vitamin D is the car that takes the calcium to where it needs to be. Otherwise, calcium will deposit wherever it wants to.
My blood work, for the most part, my doctor's very happy with. My numbers are all in the good, and not like just barely good. They're like in the good, they're in an acceptable good range. All that stuff.
If you got problems with arthritis and things like that, you definitely want to control your vitamin D and your calcium. And if you have a neurological symptoms with muscle pains, you definitely want to make sure you have your magnesium levels right. Now, a good show for the future for you, Colonel, if you ever want to do it, there's like four different kinds of magnesium. If you take the wrong ones, you're going to end up with a lot of diarrhea. So taking the right type of magnesium for the muscle and joint pains is going to be very important, and I'll let you guys figure that out.
Vitamin E or something like that. You're right. She should do something like that about the different areas.
Well, there's different types of omega-3, and there's different types of vitamin D as well. And, and then they're all important. Omega-3 is really important for cholesterol in your blood vessels and things like that. But it's really only one of the long chains of the omega-3 that really has any effect on your triglycerides. And so it's really complicated. Unless you study it, it's, you know, you're just going to listen to your doctor and he'll say take omega-3, or he'll say take vitamin D, D3, or a multi-B vitamin, or just maybe you only need folic acid, or maybe, you know, especially in alcoholics, or maybe you only need B12, you know, in some anemias. But doing metabolic studies is kind of important.
Well, we're done with the book. I mean, there's only a few more things to cover, and we can do all the vitamins and minerals and all that cool stuff next week.
Yeah, but you had gone over some of those things before, but I just wanted to point out to you, magnesium is a big player in muscle cramps, but you got to take the right magnesium, because if you take the wrong one, you're going to end up with osmotic diarrhea. And so, you know, the magnesium citrate, for example, is going to you're going to have problems. You'll be like, I don't ever want to take magnesium again. I don't care how bad my bones
are. The mag citrate. You don't want to go there.
Yep. 3 minute warning.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Wow,
all right. I'll shut up, Colonel. You're on.
Go ahead, Bobby.
Another great informative show there, Miss Kim. Thank you.
Oh, no problem.
And thank you to everybody who participated tonight. God bless America. God bless our kids, our veterans, our first responders, our military, and God bless the Defender 7. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night. God bless you all.
Good night.
Good night.